Speaking of government jobs where you don't need a college degree, wanted 535 people to write laws in Washington, D.C. part-time. Must be willing to campaign for election and grovel for money full-time. College degree not necessary. According to the Congressional Research Service, roughly about 5% of the members of Congress don't have degrees. One senator in Alaska and at least 25 House members. Another 7 members of the House have associate's degrees as their highest level of education. There are a few PhDs on Capitol Hill as well, but would anyone with any level of education actually design the predicament we are in regarding the so-called fiscal cliff? All of the automatic triggers and deadlines and expiration dates and debt ceilings and continuing resolutions are the Rube Goldberg creation of the U.S. Congress. Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the Columbia Business School and former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, dean of the Columbia Business School, I'm wondering if I could ask you a very naive sort of economics 101 question regarding Washington.
Okay.
You know, I don't understand why economic policy doesn't proceed on a basis of need and instead is dominated by these, it seems to me, false deadlines and expiration dates and various sort of fiscal cliff constructs that don't really need to be there but for some style of doing business down in Washington. What do you think?
Well, I think you're 100% right in the question. You know, none of these fiscal problems, as large as they are beyond our grasp. And our dysfunction is less about economics than it is about politics. As you said, artificial deadlines that can lead to jarring changes that affect people's lives, which means part of the resolution of the fiscal cliff will have to be some process changes in how we do the budget.
So, for instance, when a tax cut has an expiration date, then when it expires, it's described then as raising taxes when it's actually not technically that. But there's never just a basic discussion of how much tax do we need to collect to do the business of government and how much business of government should we do in terms of spending money. That never gets discussed, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's exactly the question we need to start with. The first order question for the American people is, what's the size and scope of government that you want? What do you want government to do? How big should that government be? And then the tax discussion is really how to most efficiently finance that number. Currently, our leaders talk about taxes and spending as if they're different subjects. And of course, at the end of the day, they have to come together. If we want a larger government, and many Americans seem to want that, we would have to have a tax system that pays for that. If we want a smaller government, that's a different tax system. But you're absolutely right. We have to lead with what's the size and scope of government.
It seems to me that the spending in Washington is historically high, but the taxation rates, if you include all the aggregate taxation, marginal rates, effective rates, that sort of thing, historically speaking, the tax rates are historically low, and that's an unsustainable combination.
Well, we're certainly in a fiscally unsustainable situation. If we had a healthier economy, this tax system would probably raise between 18 and 18.5% of GDP. Prior to the financial crisis, the long-term spending average was about 20% of GDP, so that would be a modest deficit, 20 minus 18.5. Spending, of course, is quite elevated. If we want to keep current levels of spending, we would have to raise taxes. And by the way, we'd have to raise taxes on everyone because all of the tax increases that the president has proposed on upper-income households are about 1% of GDP. We're many times that off in terms of higher spending. So really the question for the American people is, do we want to raise everyone's taxes to pay for this government or do we want to change the government? But that's just the math.
What's the entitlement program that you would endorse in terms of reducing the expenditures for Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, programs of that sort?
Well, it's a great question because the country's budget problems are principally about spending and they're principally about entitlement spending. And it strikes me, going back to the earlier discussion we had, we want to ask, what do we want government to do? It seems to me that the right answer for entitlements is to secure them and even strengthen them for the least well-off among us. But why are we running Social Security and Medicare systems for upper-income households? So how would you translate that? We need to slow the rate of growth of benefits for upper-income people. We can do that by changing indexation formulas, eligibility requirements. That's a technical detail. But we need to accept the proposition that upper-income people should be getting less. That seems to me the core of any entitlement reform. For Social Security, by the way, those changes would absolutely right the ship. Medicare's harder because it's both a demographic issue and a rising healthcare cost issue.
But why doesn't that discussion come up in Washington? It seems to me that part of this intransigent discussion over whether we raise rates on the rich or not doesn't include whether we reduce benefits for the rich at the same time or get rid of some of the huge corporate subsidy programs like the oil depletion allowance just to give us a pool of money to begin to work on this. It's all very, very narrow and, strident without much in the way of solid economics behind it.
You're right. We're over-constraining the problem. We need to put everything on the table. I think that was part of the genius of the Bowles-Simpson Commission work of putting everything on the table and then start afresh on the tax code and spending. To my mind, of course, upper-income people should be making the bulk of the sacrifices and righting the fiscal ship. But I don't see why that should be done by raising, distorting marginal tax rates as opposed to cutting benefits. It's the same people. And whatever distribution argument you make for one, you could make for the other with less economic damage. The Bowles-Simpson Commission actually cut marginal rates substantially but raised revenue. So there are tax reforms that will do that. And it's not magic. It's about changing the way we treat deductions and exemptions and exclusions. That's an alternative. But I think in a sense the taxation of the rich argument is a bit of a red herring because however we solve that problem, it's small compared to the real fiscal problem.
All right. Glenn Hubbard, Dean of Columbia Business School and former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.